to review the main ideas there, and then maybe continue from there. So I started to claim that there was a very different fate for the two revolutions that happened at the beginning of last century, relativity and quantum mechanics. In the case of relativity, or first let me say that both theories or both revolutions uncovered features of nature that were very, very non-intuitive because they were very different from our everyday experience. But in the case of relativity, Einstein was able to come out with very beautiful thought experiments that just used the fact that the velocity of light is universal, is invariant under transformation from one frame to the other. Just based on this axiom, he was able to show that all the non-intuitive features of relativity comes out logically from that single fact. So once any student or anyone that wants to study relativity goes through this thought experiment, he can develop intuition, new intuition about these features that were very different from our everyday macroscopic experience. Since I started just two sentences ago, I will say them. I will say them again. So what I'm doing now is review briefly the talk that I gave last time. So I started by describing the two revolutions that came at the beginning of last century, relativity and quantum mechanics. Both of them revealed very non-intuitive new features of nature because they are very different from our everyday experience. But the fate of these two theories, of these two revolutions, was very different. In the case of relativity, Einstein was able to come out with a beautiful set of thought experiments that just used the one fact that the velocity of light is the same for all observers. From this, he was able to deduce logically, just from this principle, all those non-intuitive new features, and that allows everybody that studies relativity to follow these sort of experiments and indeed develop new intuition. New intuitions, new way to think above the mathematics about relativity. I want to say something very important for the rest of our discussion. When we have a mathematical theory, be it relativity or Schrödinger equation for quantum mechanics, this is just mathematics. And we can use this mathematics to solve problems, but this mathematics never helps you, never helps us to ask the right questions about the theory. Because in order to be able to ask the right questions about the theory, the mathematics is neutral. We can ask it any question and then we will be able to calculate the results. But what are the interesting questions to ask that is beyond this mathematics? So unless we develop intuition above the mathematics that doesn't simply follow the elements of the mathematics itself, we are missing the whole point. There is a guy here by the name of Lee Smalley that wrote a beautiful article saying what was unique about Einstein. He would say that what was unique about Einstein is that he was telling stories about physics, namely, he was not a slave of the mathematics. He was able to think above the mathematics and define the correct way to think about it by stories that uses logical elements that are independent of the mathematics. So in the case of relativity, as I said, we can do that. But in the case of quantum mechanics, this is not the case. If we look what happened to the develop of quantum mechanics, in fact, many times you read something like that. The teachers of quantum mechanics should first tell their students never to ask questions, never to think what it means, just to do the calculation, to learn how to do the calculation, and then they will be in business. Because, as Feynman says in his book, If you try to ask really what it means, namely, learn to tell the story about quantum mechanics, you will run into deep abysses, yeah? You will fall into a deep hole. So it would better never ask this question. Feynman, in fact, predicted that nobody ever will understand quantum mechanics. It's so unbelievably, the features they describe in nature are so unbelievably foreign to us that we will never be able to understand it. So the whole purpose of my 1 month being here and my discussion is to show that Feynman was wrong, that we can develop a new way to think about quantum mechanics that will be just as logical as the discussions of relativity, and it will all follow from one principle, just like the principle of the universal velocity of light. The principle that distinguishes quantum mechanics from classical physics, and we can deduce from it everything else, is the principle of non-locality. If we look at the difference between quantum mechanics and classical physics, people up to now always paid attention to the kinematic difference, namely that in classical physics, a particle at a given time is described just by a position and velocity. In quantum mechanics, suddenly there is a fantastic, very different description. The particle, instead of being described in one dimension by a point, it is described by this crazy whole function, infinite number of parameters, and nobody knows what they mean, but that was the beginning. And you, Schrödinger said how to calculate how this function evolves in time, that will tell us the whole future. But the thing that started with, which is this function with infinite number of numbers, has nothing to do with physics. You can't come to a single particle electron asking, what are the values of a function at every point of space? No way to do it. So there is this mysterious mathematical language that says, in classical physics, this we can speak about probability, the given number at each point of space, but it doesn't mean that the particle knows all these numbers. The particle is just a point. The probability has to do about our knowledge about the initial condition that allows us to calculate these numbers. But this infinite set of probabilities has nothing to do with a single individual particle. It can do only with an ensemble of particles. So in quantum mechanics, we say maybe this tries just the same thing. But no, people say, hey, wait, there is a fundamental difference between classical probability and quantum one. Because in quantum one, you are not supposed to speak about probability. There is something new that's called amplitude. So you have an amplitude in space. And what is the meaning of this amplitude different from probabilities? You can only see it indirectly by seeing what will happen to the particle later when it comes from two slits. You see, the only way to understand what happened before is that some mysterious thing went through each one of these slits. This is the amplitude that went through each one of the slits. But you ask yourself, what really happened in space? Did really something move in space during these two slits? There's no way to see it, because if you try to see it, you will always see all of it in one place or all of it in the other place. The electron has charge and mass, and you will never see this charge splitting to parts that goes one place or another. So what is the story that we can tell about this amplitude? Nothing independent from what the mathematics is telling us. So I want to show to you that there is a new story to tell, a new way to think about this mystery that will show what really is new quantum mechanics, and then it will let us develop intuition through intuition above the mathematics. Because up to now, everybody that discusses quantum mechanics, you can have unbelievable stories about it. Some people say psi is not describing what is there, it's describing what you know about what is there. One crazy idea. Then there is even more crazy idea, unbelievable, which is the following. How to understand that a single particle, like an electron, can be in two different locations at the same time? Some people that invent a new idea that is called many-world, and see how crazy this idea. We come and look at the particle, and the particle can be either here or here. So when we look at it, We will always see all of it as one place. But comes in mathematics and tells us you are wrong. That's not what happened. What happened is that you yourself split into two, and now the macroscopic world is also at the same time at two different locations. For example, I do a Stern Gerlach experiment, and I decide to myself, if I see the particle goes up, I will go back to Israel. If the particle goes down, I will stay here. Beautiful. I look at there, I saw it up, I'm here. But the mathematics tells me that's not true. In fact, you saw both of them. And you are now not only particles, you are now at two different locations at the same time. You are at the same time here and in Israel. What does it mean? You will never know what it means because you never experience it. What it means is what the mathematics tell you. See what's going on here. We become slaves of the mathematics. There is no experience that we have about being at the same time. I don't have an experience of being at the same time here in Israel, but the mathematics tells me, yes, you are there. Okay? So I'm a slave of the mathematics. Anyone that believes in the many worlds, it becomes a slave of the mathematics. What?
Kuryakim Aharonov is not such a bad idea. Was it?
But you will have an experience, so it's irrelevant.
But what do you think this is crazier than the collapse of the wave function? What do you think this is crazier than the collapse of the wave function?
What do you mean? There's nothing crazy about it. You just rely on. No, no. Let's not compete. Let's not compete about crazy ideas. I can give you many, many of them.
Compared to the multiverse,
it's normal. Crazy, right?
Nothing to do with science.
So how can we understand the two-slit experiment without having to say that the particle went at the same time through both slits? Is there another way to think about it? Here's a logical way to think about it. Suppose the particle always goes through one slit, but the particle has another property, which we'll describe later. This property has non-local equations of motion. Namely, this property, contrary to all our usual experience that tells us that anything that happened in physics must be described locally. Quantum mechanics now introduces a new idea. Going back, this is a very interesting thing. Remember, when Newton started with physics, in fact, we had no local description. The sun and the earth interacted immediately. So Newton, in fact, was a little bit unhappy about it, but there was no other description. Then came Maxwell and showed that any interaction is mediated by messengers, like fields. And then the only thing that explains why one particle feels something is not because we have moved the source here, it's because the messenger came to it with velocity of light and telling, look, now you should feel something. So we went back to we developed a whole intuition about locality, that everything in nature must interact locally. Quantum mechanics reveals suddenly that in the quantum domain there is a true non-locality. And this non-locality is consistent with causality in a very, very subtle way that we will have to describe. So I will tell you now the thing that later I will develop more carefully, that the way to think about the two slits is the particle always goes through one slit. It has another property that will dictate its interference pattern later, the slit on the particle, but it has no local equation of motion that tells it whether the other slit is open or not. And that will be a way to speak about a story. Okay, I don't depend now on the mathematics. I tell you a story that quantum mechanics reveals a new feature of nature, which is described dynamically by having commutation relations instead of Poisson brackets for the basic dynamics of physics. And as I showed last talk, and you could see it in the article that was written by Sandro about it in Nature, that the fundamental difference between commutation dynamics and Poisson bracket dynamics, namely classical dynamics and quantum dynamics, is the fact that in quantum mechanics, there are properties of the particle that are described by modular variables that I will discuss more carefully in future lectures. Those properties A have no local equations of motion, and B, at later time, they show themselves in local description that is equivalent to the interference pattern. So this is a very logical, simple story. It raises some different, very fundamental questions. For example, if the particle knows immediately when it passes whether the other switch is open or not, why can't I send information faster than light? Just when the particle goes to the one switch, I will close immediately the other switch, and the particle will have to know by this variable that something has changed. So comes now beautiful uncertainty principle that saves you. That thing, that property that is affected intermediately, you can't check that change locally because it's completely uncertain. So from this one non-locality, we also develop the necessity for uncertainties. Otherwise, there will be no consistency. So you see already the beginning of how from one principle of non-locality, you can begin to develop intuition about everything else that happens to quantum mechanically. This is a very, very concise story. That's really, if you understand that, you don't have to stay in the rest of my talk. Because everything that I'm going to tell later is just more and more details about this. But of course, when you develop better and new intuition, you can also ask new interesting questions, and then you can see that you can uncover, as I've done, beautiful features of quantum mechanics that were missed before, because when you are a slave of the mathematics, you don't know how to ask the right questions. Yes?
Is this non-local theory you're describing the pilot wave theory?
Yeah? Say it again?
Your explanation of the two slits sounded like de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory.
No, because in the case of Bohm, you still say there is something that goes through the other slit. I'm saying that, namely this empty wave, which you can actually observe in all kinds of theoretic experiments. No, it has nothing to do with Bohm. It really says that it's empty, the other slit is empty, nothing went there. There are particles went here with all its properties which are sitting on the particle, nothing went through the other slit. But the thing that sits on the particle has no local equations of motion that knows whether the other slit is open or not.
So what, if, for someone who's familiar with the pilot wave theory, what would you describe your approach? How does it distinguish itself in terms of conceptual advantages of this approach over the existing pilot wave theory?
This will be the next thing. I'm going to show, okay, let me say, if you have a vector in Hilbert space, psi, you can describe these vectors in two fundamentally different ways. One, you can take this vector and expand it in a complete set of eigenvectors, like the Schrödinger representation, is to write this vector as an integral of psi of x times complete set of continuous eigenvectors x dx. And you say, in order to know this vector, I have to know the amplitudes of each eigenvector, okay? These are the Schrödinger wave. Of course, I could expand it in momentum representation, I could expand it in energy representation that may be discrete. These are many, many different ways of describing this vector, and all those ways have nothing to do with what we can really measure, because we cannot measure on a single particle or its coefficient. On the other hand, we can describe this vector by what I call deterministic operators. Namely, if I take, and this is the correct description, if I take a vector psi, I can ask the question, what are all the eigen operators of this vector? Namely, what are the set of all operators, ai, that have psi as a common eigenvector? So this is a number times psi. These are set of operators or observables that you can measure without disturbing psi. And they have some very interesting properties if you look at the whole family. But before I do this, let me just show how this works in a very simple space. Suppose I have a Hilbert space with finite number of dimensions, say four dimensions. Okay? So this is a particular vector. This is a particular vector, and I can ask now, in the dual space of the matrices, I have now a space of 16 dimensions, which are all the Hermitian matrices that connect to this space, okay? This is now a different vector space because the sum of any two matrices multiplied by number is another matrix. But it's a real space because if I look at Hermitian matrices, I'm only allowed to add them with real coefficients. So I have on one side the ordinary Hilbert space that has four dimensions but four complex parameters, two of them are trivial, so it's really six dimensions. And here I can speak about all the matrices, the Hermitian matrices, that alternate and give you another vector. Among them, the set of all matrices that have non-zero here, zero here, zero here, and here, zero here, zero here, and here, and all entrances here, these are all could be arbitrary numbers. If I look at this set of matrices, all of them have one common vector, which is this Eigen vector, which is this one. They uniquely define it, because if I take any entrance here, some of these matrices will change it. But all these matrices don't change this vector, right? So therefore, I have here a complete set of observables. I can observe all of them without disturbing the state. And they uniquely define the state. All right? So I now have a new possibility of describing dynamics, which is instead of describing psi of t by looking how its coefficient in the position representation are changing, that is what's called Schrödinger equation, I instead look at the Heisenberg equation. Heisenberg tells me that you have all these matrices, which are functions of position momentum for one dimension, and you now ask, what is that set changing as a function of t so that it becomes the eigenvector at a later time, all right? Now, Heisenberg tells me, instead of looking at the change in the Hilbert space, look at the change of these operators. Because if you calculate this, and you for this you use Heisenberg equation of motion, then you can follow the evolution by actually describing something that happened in real physics, because you can observe those things on a single particle. They don't change what the system that you are looking. So you have now a very simple description of physics saying that a single particle is described in a given time, just by this set of observables. I'm telling you how these observables are changing as a function of time. And you will see that the new thing that happens, the only new difference between classical and quantum mechanics in this description is not that you disturb the system, is not that you do collapse, is not that you do have uncertainties. The only difference is that some of these variables, although classically they are described by the time evolution of this variable is described by Poisson brackets, which are local. Quantum mechanically, the time evolution of these operators will have non-local elements exactly at the time when we have interference like two-slit experiment. Now, I want to stop now for a few minutes. Let me ask questions because I'm not sure that I get to you. So, I'm stopping now, and I'm not going to continue unless I hear a number of intelligent questions. Okay. Who volunteers? Okay, goodbye.
So you're saying for every state in Hilbert space,
yeah,
you consider it in the Heisenberg picture, so it doesn't evolve at all. It
doesn't work?
You consider it in the picture, so there's no evolution.
No evolution of the state. The state is just a boundary condition.
So for every state, there exists
right.
A set
in fact,
of
right.
Operators, mm-hmm. which can be observed in
yeah.
the state?
Yeah, in principle, they can be observed. There may be some limitations. Okay, this is a very intelligent question, so... You see, I already have an intuition about the mathematics because you ask good questions. Even not realizing it, right? Okay, so we can consider two types of Heisenberg equation of motion. One is for a completely classical space-time. If we consider, if we imagine that we have developed quantum mechanics, the quantum mechanics was developed before relativity, then you can consider space-time, which is the Galilean space-time, not Lorentzian space-time, meaning that you have absolute time. In this absolute time, you are allowed to consider arbitrary Hamiltonians, which are any function of position momentum. You can write a Hamiltonian, which is any function of position momentum. For example, you can write in the Hamiltonian cosine p. I mean, if you look at people discussing classical physics before relativity, they were playing around with arbitrary Hamiltonians as a function of position momentum. They described action angle variables, all kinds of. Now, if you describe quantization of that Hamiltonian, then indeed you can observe any Hermitian operator. Because you can write, like Schrödinger, like von Neumann said, take a Hamiltonian, you have the free Hamiltonian, S to its coupling g of t times any observable you want to write, times some pointer, and then that will, you can observe then any A, any observable, provided you are allowed to write in the Hamiltonian any function of position momentum. Now, the minute you, even when you consider non-relativistic limits of the Lorentzian space-time, then you have a problem, because suppose you write an Hamiltonian H, which is cosine of the momentum of the particle. You just switch a coupling like that. What does it do? You have the particle started initially here. Let's say the particle is localized here. You apply this thing cosine PL over H bar. This thing makes the particle jump from here to here, because this is a translation operator. It translates the wave function from here to here instantaneously. So let's see what it means in space-time. I have the particle, suppose this is x and this is t. I have a particle that was sitting here all the time, and then I apply this cosine p, and the particle jumps from here to here. This is consistent if you have absolute time. But if you have Lorentzian time, then if we look at this being equal time, for another observer, you see what will happen. In this case, there will be suddenly two particles, because this wave cuts here, this cuts here. So in this description, I will have two particles. In this description, I will have no particle for a while. So therefore, the only way that you are allowed to do what von Neumann says, namely introduce a measurement of any Hermitian operator, that is only if you believe that you discuss only truly classical quantization of classical physics where you have absolute time. What do you do if you are not allowed to do that in real life? You have to learn how to observe these non-local things indirectly, and I will show you how this can be done. So your question is, can we always observe anything? The answer is yes, but you have to be very subtle about it. You can't simply brute force introduce in the Hamiltonian interaction proportional to any operator, because that will introduce problems with conservation law, with causality. So let me now tell you a historical story that you will find, hopefully find very funny.
Yeah. There is no problem with introducing cosine of p.
Hmm?
If I have an absolute time, there's no
problem. Yeah, if I have absolute time.
Then there is no problem.
No problem, right. Okay.
So you're saying just because I have an idea of relativity.
Yeah, even though in the classical, even though the particle is moving very slowly, I can still look at it from both of another long frame, then I will be having a problem. Historical story that you will find hopefully funny. One third of my thesis, my PhD thesis, has to do with some issues concerning measurement theory and relativity in the following way. I asked myself the question, what happens if I try to measure the momentum? Not cosine momentum, that's the momentum itself, velocity, the most fundamental thing. If I try to measure it at a very short time, I reduce the uncertainty of the momentum, I must increase the uncertainty of position. So suppose my measurement lasts at a period delta t. Then I know that the biggest uncertainty in position that I can introduce is c times delta t. I cannot introduce bigger uncertainty in position because that will violate causality. I start the particle here in position, I measure the momentum, the particle immediately later must have a larger uncertainty in position. That uncertainty cannot be introduced faster than c times delta t, the increase of it, right? Otherwise it will violate causality. So I suddenly have a new problem because I can describe in quantum mechanics, I can describe a particle in, say, a constant force. If the particle has a constant force, its momentum evolves as a function of time. There is no way to follow this evolution very carefully because of this restriction. So I say that indicates there is some kind of tension between the mathematical description and what can be done in observing it. And we'll have more to say about it later. But the story I want to tell you is the following. In 1958, all of you were not alive yet, but I was doing that time my PhD. My thesis advisor, David Bohm, was invited to come to the Niels Bohr Institute. And he took me along with him. And I was walking in the corridor of that institute and met the assistant of Niels Bohr, O. Petersen. And he asked me what I was doing, so I told him about that thing. He said, oh, I think it's interesting. Maybe I will try to arrange a meeting between you and Bohr. The great Bohr, well, I was extremely excited. Yes, I want to meet. So a meeting was arranged. There was a small room. There was a little table here with two chairs. I was sitting here and Bohr was sitting there. The audience were David Bohm, my thesis advisor, and all pieces. That's all. And I say to Professor Bohr, Professor Bohr, I would like to discuss with you some ideas I have about measurement theory. And I didn't even have a chance to say relativity. He said, oh, yes, I have to tell you something. I swear to God, he gave me a lecture that lasted a whole hour of everything that I knew by heart about his ideas of measurement theory. And then he said, this was a very interesting conversation. He goes up and left. I was flabbergasted. It was unbelievable. What was going on? Probably this was his way of getting rid of Nudnik, you know? He said, you know what a Nudnik is? Somebody that you ask him how are you and give you a lecture for an hour how he feels. That's a Jewish word for somebody that talks forever. So he probably thought that because I came with Bohm and he did not understand and didn't believe in the ideas of Bohm, I'm going to tell him something crazy like that. So he wanted to do this game with me. So I came out of the corridor to the corridor. People looked at me, what happened? Because they saw that I said what happened, say, okay, don't feel so bad. Let's tell you that 2 years ago Feynman came and met Bohr in the same room. And he started to tell him about his path integral idea. The minute he mentioned to him that he wants to do amplitude to add passes, Bohm gave him a lecture for an hour why you should not do something with passes and went away. So I felt a little bit better. Okay, more questions, more intelligent questions. Yes.
One good thing about the wave function is to specify you need 2n minus 2 real numbers.
Yeah.
So 2n because there are complex numbers and minus 2 because of normalization of normal phase.
Mm-hmm.
To specify the set of operators you mentioned,
would require, well, each one of them requires a large number of real numbers, and then you require infinitely many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a more efficient way of describing that collection of operators?
Right, actually, if you have a vector 1, 0, 0, 0, it's enough just to specify that particular function, which is a projection operator. Zeros everywhere else apart from this. This by itself will uniquely define that thing, that projection operator. Or you add all of those only because there are some physical variables that are interesting, which will be a combination of this and part of that. But to specify the function, it's enough just to specify by using the projection operator, which are function of position momentum. So instead of having this, you can ask, what is the observable, which is the projection operator on that thing, expressed as a function of position momentum, which I will show you in some future lecture how to do, and that is the thing that you can measure completely defined the state.
Okay.
But the reason why you add also the other, which are seem to be superfluous, is because there are some interesting physical physical observables, which are a combination of this one plus particular combination of those that will be of physical interest.
Okay?
Your intelligent question. It passes the
infinite number?
Well, because there are infinitely many matrices that satisfy that role.
Well, yeah, but the number of parameters.
Well,
any
given
one of the parameters.
N minus one components, so it's just right. I mean,
N squared minus one minus N minus one. It's not. I mean, that's true.
It's bigger. The real question is why work with a bigger space, right? Small space will do. And the answer is physical reason. Other question? That passes the test. It was an intelligent question. Yeah. Yes. So you mentioned that your diameter non-locality didn't imply superluminal signaling.
Diameter non-locality?
You said it did not imply signals faster than the
speed. That's right.
Because of the uncertainty principle.
Yeah.
But some people think that the content of relativity theory is not just no signals faster than light, but also no influences of any kind faster than light.
There will be.
And so you seem to be disagreeing with that approach. But the question really is, does this commit you to the existence of a preferred rest frame?
No. It has nothing to do with preferred rest frame.
So how do you have superluminal causes?
Because the question is good, but wait until I will discuss more carefully all this non-locality. But in principle, what you have to write is this. You have to look at this operator, e to the I p mu l mu over h bar, and look at the class of this operator, and look at the, and this is a compliant way of describing what happens in the exchange. But wait till I come to discuss it, okay? I don't have to need a preferred frame from this. Any other questions? Yes.
It's more of a comment than a question.
Okay.
You know, you raise this diagram where it looks like the particle is moving, and you say really correctly, you know, that doesn't happen in the relativity. But there's a caveat, which is it doesn't happen in relativity when you don't have a fundamental landscape. But it's interesting that the same diagram, if you turn on gravity,
mm-hmm.
so if you turn on G Newton, which produce a fundamental landscape, there's a context where a similar diagram
I know,
appears.
I know. It's well known that if you, even before relativity, before general relativity, perhaps the best description of a normalization is to describe field theory on lattice of points. When you write a lattice of points in space and time, obviously you violate Lorentz invariant because you have a preferred frame. But you show that when you, this length is very small, but you look at wavelengths that are very long compared to this, then you retrieve the Lorentz invariance, but the fundamental description is not Lorentz invariant. So that's what you are describing, where it's necessarily in general relativity, but also in fact, it's quite necessary in order to do proper normalization.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you, and there you retrieve, indeed, you start with something that violates Lorentz invariant, and then you can do this game there. In fact, if you look at the if you look at the way that you describe partition on a lattice, the fundamental thing is not to describe continuous situation, but to describe something that jumps from this point to this point, which is like the modular momentum. So the modular momentum there is from the beginning playing an important role. But I'm describing things that are that grow with cosine PL, where L is much, much larger than this very small point distance, and then I will have the problem that I'm talking about. Any other questions? Yes?
At the risk of being a nudnik, I'm still stuck.
Speaking louder.
At the risk of being a nudnik, I'm still stuck with the uncertainty momentum relation.
Yeah.
Position uncertainty momentum relation. Paradoxically, I find it easier with the wave picture to do the following. I have a flat wave coming to my slit.
Yeah. You don't have it. Mathematics has it. You don't have it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
It's a mathematics effect.
Yeah.
So if it's flat, it means that momentum at every point is just the same.
The momentum is also, it means the momentum is zero, not the momentum at every point. Every point you have phase. The phase is constant, okay? The momentum is zero, yeah?
But now, if I make the slit narrow, then I am measuring the position more
accurately.
I know how, pictorially, I know how I pay the price. At the wave which emerges to it, I'm not going to mention the word which you hate, but the wave now is dispersed. So that's an easy.
That is very simple, but now you go the opposite direction. You say, I now start with the wave here. And now in a very short time, I want to find out what is the momentum. So if I was able at a very short time to make a measurement, suddenly from being here, the wave function is now here. But I can't do that. Because if this would happen, then I have a probability of starting a particle here and appearing later much further than the velocity of light times the time.
If I just wipe out the rest of the wave, and the part of the wave which emerged from the slit is now going to all directions. So this is my...
No, but it cannot go faster than light. That's the problem. In no relativistics, it can go in all directions very quickly. So it can cover all space immediately, non-relativistically. But if you put the restriction that nothing can move faster than light, if you start at this small distance, a small place, it can only propagate with velocity of light, so it cannot have definite momentum immediately. So that means, for example, suppose the particle has a definite momentum, and suppose I have a constant force. So I can write an equation that the momentum p is equal to p0 plus the force times t. So now we have a time evolution of the momentum that continuously changing. There is no way to come and test the change very quickly, because there is no way to make a measurement of the momentum as quickly as you like. This is the part that, if you're interested in more, find my thesis and read about it. All right. But that's a side remark. Any other questions? Shall we have intermission of 10 minutes and then we'll continue? Okay? Okay, is it okay now? Any questions?
So one question.
Yes.
You're emphasizing the Heisenberg.
Right.
But suppose now you separate the three part, like you did in the Hamiltonian series, and go into the interacting picture.
Yeah.
I mean, do you get something special, or do you separate just the non-local variables? Because in the Heisenberg picture, you're going to have local variables and non-local. Right?
Yeah.
And you will have to give me some other criteria. Maybe it will be causality or something. How you separate the non-local ones, the non-local observer? I mean, suppose you go to the interactive picture, you separate the
free space. I know. Wait, this will be discussed in another lecture also there. Okay. So that will entice you to come to my other lecture. So there are two things that I dislike very much about the way that our fathers talk about quantum mechanics. One was the idea that really was described as an electron is this wave that is not there. And the other is the idea that a quantum system, in particular a quantum particle, has no properties really, in the sense that every property that we observe depends as much as on our method of observation, and not only on the property of the particle itself. Heisenberg came out with his famous uncertainty principle, discussing the fact that if you do any measurement in quantum mechanics, if you want to see a particle, for example, an electron, you have to shine light on it. Light is made out of quanta of energy, out of photons, and therefore, at the least, in order to see the particle, one photon must hit it, and because the particle is very light, that collision with the photon will necessarily introduce a disturbance. And therefore, we can never think about the particle independent of the observer. They are sort of married together. You can't separate them. And therefore, you can't think about properties of a quantum system as really there, as a real reality in the quantum domain. I heard Wheeler telling a story trying to exemplify what this means. And he said that when he was young, he was playing with a group of his friends the game of 20 questions. Namely, somebody goes out of the room, the rest of the group selects something, maybe an object or a person, and then he comes back, and by asking questions that they are allowed to answer only yes or no, eventually he has to find out, hopefully, what they selected. So one time he said he was going out of the room, coming back, starting to ask questions, and after a while he felt that something is strange, but he did not know what it is. And finally he said, "You selected the cloud," and said yes. But then they told him the secret. The secret was that they decided not to select anything, but only to answer consistently. So for example, if you would say, ask one time, is the object big? And somebody answers yes, nobody later will answer yes on the thing being small. So the only restriction was that the answer should be consistent. And then finally, when he said cloud, he conversed by all his questions to cloud, they said yes. But of course, they didn't select the cloud. The cloud wasn't there. It's the question, the observation, that made it there. He said, this is what happened in quantum mechanics. You can't speak about the electron having properties by itself. Those properties are dictated more by what we do to the particle than what was really there, all right? So again, this is not a way to tell a story. If we want to tell a story, it's by telling a story about what is really there, and not about this mishmash of saying that we change the thing. So I will show you how to discuss only measurements that never change what you try to observe. One example was these deterministic operators. But that is not enough, because it turns out that the real content of quantum mechanics can be found when you consider an ensemble of particles that have the same property, or a single particle where you repeat defining it many times to have the same property. Then suddenly you can find a whole rich new reality that you can observe without any disturbance at all. And let me show you what is this new reality that is very, very rich and very interesting, provided you learn to ask the right questions. So the beginning of the story was in 1962, when I was wondering about the question whether it is true that when you make a measurement and a collapse on a quantum system, you necessarily introduce time irreversibility. The usual idea was that if you have a particle, for example, if a particle has sigma z equal to plus 1, the spin is positive in the z direction. And then you come and make a measurement and find the particle in the x direction equal to plus 1. There is no way afterwards to find out whether you started with sigma z equal to plus 1 or you started with sigma z equal to minus 1, because the end result would be the same. So this collapse introduced irreversibility. That was the idea, that in quantum mechanics, from the beginning, the theory is truly microscopically irreversible, because any time you do a measurement, you introduce time irreversibility. And so I was wondering, is it possible to rescue time irreversibility in the macroscopic world, even if you have a collapse or measurement? And it occurred to me that it's possible to rescue this time reversibility if you consider two boundary conditions in time instead of one. So how do you do that? If this is time, and we start at time t1 with a state psi1 for our system, any quantum system, then the usual description is that this evolves as a function of time according to the Schrödinger equation. Now, if you start with many particles, each one of them with the same state psi1, so each one of them will evolve exactly the same way. So the time evolution of all of them will be exactly the same. They will all be described by the same state. But now, at time t2, I come and measure some observable that has a possible outcomes, phi1, or phi2, or phi3. These are possible eigenfunctions of the new observable. Or if you want to have some real picture, I start with n atoms, all of them in the same excited state at time t1. And then I observe when they decay. Some of them may decay after 1 minute, some of them may decay after 1 hour, some of them even may decay after 1 year. So there is a possibility of doing a post-selection, asking what are the properties of all those atoms. They decay after 1 minute. What was their properties between the two times? The initial time when they started in the excited state, and the final time when we observed them, the decay. What can we say about the time in between these two boundary conditions? Now, I want to make sure that you understand that there is no way to do it in classical physics. Because in classical physics, if I start with two particles that have the same initial condition and they have the same Hamiltonian, there is no way later to select them differently, because they will later have the same property. But quantum mechanically, even though all of this has the same wave function coming from the past, if I do here a measurement, very simple. Suppose each one of these particles was in a superposition of two cavities, 1/√2 times left plus right. Okay, so I started the particle in two cavities with linear superposition of being here and here. At a later time, I can open the boxes and see for each particle whether it's the right box or in the left box. In half of them, I will find the right box, and half of them, I will find the left box. Then it's legitimate to ask the question, in the time in between, was there any difference between those cases or not? Because the wave function from the past say that they were all described the same way. But I know that because the particle could not jump from here to here, I know that if I find it here, it must have been there all the time in between. And those particles must have been all the time in between. So I get extra information from the second boundary condition that information is unique to quantum mechanics. Because in classical theory, two things that started the same way cannot give me different answers later. This is extremely important. So I define this notion as the idea of pre- and post-selected ensemble. Pre- and pre-selected ensemble means that all the particles started the same way. Post-selected ensemble meaning that I am going to collect information as a present only from those particles that will end up later at the same state. So for example, if I have these two boxes here, and I know I can divide the ensemble of particles for this about one half that were here found and another half that were here, this would be a pre- and post-selected ensemble if I can do some experiment at time in between and first write all the results, but later erase all the results for this case, only keep the results for this one, then I will have things that I measure on pre- and post-selected ensemble. Is this point clear? It has to be absolutely clear before I continue. If you have any question, ask it now. Okay, so let's see what we can say about pre- and post-selected ensemble. One thing that I would like to say before doing the mathematics is that I historically didn't arrive it this way, but in hindsight, I could have thought about this possibility of pre- and post-selection and what is following it from the following paradox. Here's the paradox. I have two particles, particle 1, particle 2, that were prepared initially an EPR state of their spins, namely, each particle sits here, and the other particle sits there. I keep them fixed in space, but they have spins. And I prepared initially their spins such that sigma 1 plus sigma 2 is equal to 0. This is called the EPR state, or Bohm EPR state. And this says that these two spins are entangled, so that if I observe and find this spin up in this direction, I will find this spin down in this direction. If instead I do it in this, they are correlated in this. Now, let us look now at space and time, one dimension. This is x and this is c. One particle sits here, this is its red line, and the other particle sits here, and this is the red line. And initially, their spins are entangled. The sum of the spins is equal to 0. This is the initial time t1. At time t2, I come and measure on this spin 1, I measure and find the sigma z1 is equal to plus 1. So, according to the usual axiom, this particle from now on will be described by a new vector, which is sigma z equal to plus 1, which replaced the vector before that was entangled with this. But I know that if this is sigma z equal to plus 1, then I know that this spin will be sigma z 2 equal to minus 1, right? Because of the correlation. So I will say, okay, I found the spin here by measurement. I can immediately say that I also collapse this spin to the state sigma z2 is equal to minus 1. But now suppose I look at this problem from another Lorentz frame. Another Lorentz frame, this is equal time. And therefore, the other Lorentz observer will say, from this measurement, I deduce already here that sigma z2 is equal to minus 1. But then I come back to my original Lorentz frame and say, if this is equal to minus 1, then of course, this here must be equal to plus 1. But now I have a problem, because this happens before I do the measurement here. So what's going on? Either I have to say that there is no way to describe the collapse covariantly, or I have to say that maybe what this is trying to tell me is that this measurement here that found the sigma z equal to plus 1 is relevant not only to the future, but also to the past. Because if this measurement would also say that already here, sigma z was equal to plus 1 because of the measurements I have done here, something going back from the future, then I will have a covariant description of the collapse. I'm not claiming that quantum mechanics doesn't give you the correct answer to measurement. But I'm speaking not about the answer made to measurement, but about the description of the wave function. Because obviously, if I will discuss measurement, everything will be consistent. But I'm asking about the description, not about the result of actual measurement. I got here plus one. What can I say about the description of what's going on here and what's going on here, just based on this measurement? And it turns out that if I want to have a covariant description, I must send the vector also back to the past. This is just a side remark, okay? But now we come to the actual thing that was done in 1962.
Yeah, may I have a question?
Yes.
It's now instead of spin one is the V measure. Mm-hmm. Instead of V in far to the spin two is the spin the is the minus one.
Yeah.
In the sort of light speed of the light.
Mm-hmm.
Is the path. Why
yeah.
do we need it?
Right.
Why do we need it? It's the speed of light. It's the light point picture.
No, I'm saying that if I found that this is equal to plus one, yeah. I know that if I were to make a measurement here, I would get minus one also here.
Yeah, this is mathematical consistency.
Huh?
This is the mathematical consistency.
But yeah, I'm asking now, do I have a mathematical description?
Yeah.
Not the answer to measurement, but a mathematical description that is covariant. That is the question. And I don't have it.
Ah, right.
Yeah. All right? The answer to measurement will be okay, to actual measurement, but not the mathematical description. Okay, this was a side remark. But now the actual thing that was done.
I may have confirmed this situation. Is light cone is the picture? Is
what?
Is that the spin one, spin two?
Yeah.
Is the speed of light is a constant? Is that the still is it's a priori assumed? And also, this is what is the from that's the what are the viewpoint is the, how to construct is the mathematical consistency into the picture.
That's what I'm going to show. Okay, you will see after my description, then I will have a consistent mathematical picture that is covariant. Okay.
It's okay.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Now, so when I thought about this idea at that time, I was at Yeshiva University in New York, and there was another professor. I was a very young professor, just fresh after my PhD, but there was older professor, Joe Leibovitz, who was interested in statistical physics, but also in foundational quantum mechanics, and there was a visiting professor from that came every week there, who was at Syracuse. Peter Bergman, who was, by the way, the assistant of Einstein, one of his assistants, and he was also very well known in foundation. So I came to them and told them about my idea, and we together developed the thing that he calls now the ABL formalism, our own of Bergman Leibovitz, which goes like this. Here is time. I start with the state for a single particle. I start with the state psi 1. I evolve it in time according to Schrödinger equation, or any equation, so it's psi 1 of t. And then at a later time here, at time t 2, I make the post-selection and post-select a different state phi 1. And I consider now what happens when I have an ensemble of particles that all of them started with the same psi 1, and all of them, in a sub-ensemble, all of them were post-selected at phi 1, okay? So I discard all those that ended up with phi 2 or phi 3. And I ask now for this sub-ensemble, what happens if I do measurements at time in between? So this is the past, this is the future, and this is the present, sometime in the present, t. And I consider what will happen if I do here on these particles, some measurement, for example, I do a measurement of an observable A. So if I do a measurement of observable A, then I find one of the eigen functions and eigenvalues. Suppose A has a complete set of eigenfunctions alpha n. I can ask the question, what happens if I do this measurement? And I can ask the question, how many times will I get the value alpha 1? How many times I will get the value alpha 2? Not for the whole ensemble, but only for those cases. For the whole ensemble is the usual picture. For the whole ensemble, I say if I have psi, 1 of t, and I ask what is the probability to get alpha n, I have to take this times alpha n times psi 1 of t. This absolute value square will give me the probability. If I multiply by the eigenvector alpha n psi 1 of t, this thing gives me the probability to find the result alpha n if I start with an ensemble of particles that all of them are described by psi 1. But now I don't want to keep all of them. I want only to keep those that will give me phi 1 at the end. How do I do this calculation? So it's not very difficult. We do the following. I first start with psi 1 at the time t1. I evolve it in time from t1 to t by the time evolution operator. If the Hamiltonian is time independent, utt1 is equal to e to the minus I, the Hamiltonian h, times t minus t1 divided by h bar. This is the time evolution operator that takes the wave function from the time t1 to the wave function at time t, right? Then, I want to know what is the probability to find a particular alpha n here. So I multiply it by alpha n. This would be an amplitude to start with psi 1 at time t1, psi 1 at time t1, evolve it in time to t, multiply by alpha n. This will be absolute value square of this, will be the probability to start with this and get that particular answer in the middle. But now I'm not finished. I now know that if I got this, from now on, at time t, I replace psi 1 by the vector alpha n, and then I have to propagate the vector alpha n by the same time evolution, ut, up to the final time t2, and project it on psi 1. And that whole thing now gives me the amplitude to start with psi 1, get in the middle the answer alpha n, and get at the end the answer phi 1. So if I call this C1, then C1 absolute value square this is equal to exactly what I said, starting psi 1, get in the middle alpha n, and get at the end phi 1, right? Notice that if I add over all the possibilities the sum of Cn absolute value square, will I get here 1? No, because I miss all those cases that I got other answers. So therefore, if I want to, for this sub-ensemble to get the correct probability, to get alpha n, I have to take Cn square and divide by the sum of Cn square, because that is the way to normalize it properly, okay? Up to now, I didn't do anything new, and I have a very simple picture, the usual picture saying the following. Here is C, I started with Psi 1, evolved it in time until the intermediate time t. This was Psi 1 of t. From here on, I got a new vector propagating, alpha n of t, propagating from the intermediate time to the final time t2, and then I replace it with a new vector, which is phi 1 of t from then on. So this is the usual picture. I start with psi 1, evolve it in time up to here, do a measurement, replace it with the new vector, do a measurement, replace it. This is the usual picture. But now I notice I can do a trivial mathematical change that will have a completely different story. Again, story versus mathematics. I take this U and bring it here, which I'm allowed to do. I have now the same calculation as U dagger of T2T times phi 1, alpha n, U times psi 1. And this gives me exactly the same Cn. I didn't change anything because I just, it's the same thing. But the picture, the story is very different. Because U dagger is operator that goes in the opposite direction. Remember, if U is equal to e to the minus iht over h bar, U dagger is equal to e to the minus ih minus t times h bar, right? So U dagger is the thing that goes back in time. It's a time evolution backwards. So now, this thing tells me that I have all the right in the world from the point of view of mathematics. I have all the right of the world to describe what's going on here in different language. I propagate this vector from here until the intermediate time. I propagated back in time this vector up to here and use them on equal footing to find the properties of the system in the time in between. This is what we were looking as a solution for the paradox. Quantum mechanics, mathematics, tell me now I have all the right in the world to say that the collapse also acts backwards, because it gives me the same position. So even though you think it's crazy, how can the party, the president know already what I'm going to do later? Nevertheless, this tells us in the world and say, you are allowed to do this. The party is allowed to do in the present, to know the present, which experiment you are going to do in the future. Not only what result, because I could have done a different experiment that will have completely different one. This is unbelievable, unbelievable that quantum mechanics allows me to think about individual quantum systems, peer particles, know what I'm going to do in the future, as if I don't have free will. I have free will and we'll discuss it very carefully later. But this is extremely amazing that I'm allowed in the quantum mathematics to have a description that tells me the particle at the middle, each particle in the middle already knows what experiments I'm going to do in the future and which results I'm going to get. And it's completely consistent because it gives me the same prediction. So I cannot run into any problem with variation of causality or any other problem because it's the same result as the usual mathematics that's supposed to be completely consistent. This is very, very amazing. So I call from then on, I call this thing a two-vector approach to quantum mechanics or time-symmetric approach to quantum mechanics. I've retrieved the time reversibility in the microscopic world because the description is time reversible, provided I'm thinking properly about the maximum information I can have about the quantum system. The maximum information is not only what I found in the past, but also what I'm going to find in the future. And only when I use these two maximal information, I can find a very interesting new stories about the time in between. Many, many interesting new concepts and new effects. In fact, many laboratories in the world now are doing all kinds of experiments that are due to the thing that was discovered by developing this story further. This is again the lesson that if you have the right story, you can find new faces of the mathematics that you didn't find. It's an experimental fact, a real experiment that was done, social experiment that was done in quantum mechanics, showing what happens when you don't have the right story. You don't have the right story. For 100 years, people knew about all the mathematics of quantum mechanics, and they didn't develop the notion that I call now weak values, which are properties of quantum systems that appear in post-selected, that can be measured in laboratories, and it's very useful to measure in laboratories. It was there from the beginning, but people did not notice it because they did not have the right story to describe in the mathematics. Okay, very important lesson. Okay, so now let us see, what do we do with this new story?
Sorry, actually, can I interrupt you?
What?
Can I interrupt you?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so now it seems that you're going back to the classical physics picture, because now you're restoring the time reversal, which we didn't have.
No, no, it's not classical. I restore time irreversibility, but doesn't mean it's classical physics. I have shown that.
No, but we don't have the same situation when we solve the Maxwell equations. We usually ignore the advanced solution for no good reason, except.
No, this has nothing to do with the advanced solution. No, the advanced solution has to do with the fact that you use partial boundary conditions in the past and partial boundary conditions in the future. This, if you use half retarded and half advanced, you can use all fully retarded. Here, this is something that has no analogy classically, because classically, if you know the state of the field, classical field at one time, then you can't add any other information. So you can have half retard and half advanced only because you don't use all the information in the past. But here we use all the information in the past, but because we do collapses, we can use now new information from the future that has nothing to do with the half retard and half advanced. It's true that we use the time reversal solution, but it's new to quantum mechanics, so it's not the same thing. Okay, let's continue. So the thing that I did with Leibovitz and Bergman and Leibovitz rested there for a long time. Nobody paid attention. I did not pay attention to it. It was just there, just a mathematical curiosity. But about 20 years ago, I started to think again about this problem and started to feel that I'm missing something. There must be something in this story that is more than just the fact that we can restore time reversibility. So I looked at the simplest quantum system that I do in pre and post selection, and started to ask again, looking again for the right story, which I was missing. So here is the story. I have time again. I have now a spin half particle, the simplest Hilbert space that possible, simplest quantum system is possible. And I assume there is no magnetic field, so the spin components are all constant of the motions. And at time t1, I start with sigma x equal to plus 1. And at time t2, I make a measurement and find the sigma y equal to plus 1. So the old story is saying here I have a vector, one vector, that says all the time that sigma is equal to plus 1. And then from then on, I have another vector that says that sigma y is equal to plus 1. The new picture that we have is we have here one vector propagating towards the future that says that sigma is equal to plus 1, another vector propagating from here to the past that says that sigma y is equal to plus 1. And somehow we want now to say that both of them exist at the time in between, both of them. What does it mean? How can we say that both sigma x and sigma y is equal to plus 1, where everybody told us forever that if sigma is equal to plus 1, we are not allowed to know what sigma y is? And this seems to tell us that somehow this particle has both properties of sigma x equal to plus 1 and sigma y equal to plus 1. So I started to think about it, how would I be able to show that indeed the particle has both properties? So what can I do? First of all, I can measure sigma x and find one, and then afterwards measure sigma y and find one. Would this tell me anything new? No. Because I measure sigma x, find it one, because sigma x is conserved. I now measure sigma y. Half the time I will get minus one, half the time I will get plus one. I'm just throwing those answers, but it doesn't mean anything. That's because I throw it out, it doesn't mean the picture of the particle had both values. So that's not the way to see that both of them are equal to plus one. Aha, I said to myself, maybe if I measure sigma x plus sigma y, just a single measurement, I measure sigma x plus sigma y, maybe I will get one from here, I will get one from there, so I will get two. Aha! So we are getting two. But the means I thought about had your credit to myself. Well, I know that sigma x plus sigma y divided by square root of 2 is just a component of the spin in the x plus y direction. That spin can be either 1 or minus 1, never square root of 2. Oy vey, my story now led me in the wrong direction. I had a beautiful story, sigma x equal to 1, sigma y equal to 1. I deduced from this story that the sum must be 2, and I'm wrong. Should I throw the story away, or should I find some reason why the story told me the wrong thing, and I will just augment the story so it will tell me the right thing? So that is indeed what's going to happen. So let me show you how this happened. Okay, I ask myself, what's going on here? Why don't I see the value 2? But then I realize the following thing. If I look here at a short period of time where I measure sigma x plus sigma y during this period of time, how do I do such a measurement in the laboratory? I put a magnetic field in the x plus y direction. In fact, it's a non-homogeneous magnetic field, like in the Stern-Gerlach experiment, and because I don't know where the particle moves exactly, I can say that I have in the x plus y direction a magnetic field which is uncertain, because the magnetic field is not constant. Okay, so its strength depends on where the particle is. I don't know the position of the particle here. This is, I have a region here where the magnetic field is B0 times sigma x plus sigma y times mu, something like this. So divided by square root of 2. And this is times a coordinate, let's call this coordinate y. So the strength of the magnetic field depends where you are here. And you send the particle with uncertain position, so the particle field an uncertain position in the x plus y direction, uncertain magnetic field in the x plus y direction, right? Aha! So if I have a field in the x plus y direction, that field makes a precession of the spin around that direction. So the spin sigma x that was definite here starts to precess with an uncertain frequency and becomes very quickly unknown. So although the beginning was known, already in the middle here, the spin in this direction will be unknown because of the measurement. Also the spin in the y direction will be unknown. So during this period, what I wanted to see was in sigma x1 and sigma y1, that measurement necessarily destroys what I want to see. That's why I don't see it. So how do I save the day? So I decided that the only hope to be able to see this new picture is to come out with a new possibility, which I call weak measurements. Now I call it weak measurement. I ask myself, is it possible to come and interact with this particle in the intermediate time with a measuring device that interacts with it so weakly that it doesn't disturb either sigma x or sigma y? And we will see that there is a possibility like this. So let's call it weak measurement. Weak measurement is a property, a measurement, that the measuring device interacts so weakly with the particle that it does not change its properties. The question is now, under this condition, maybe I don't gain any information. So there's no point in doing that. Turns out something very surprising, that if you do a measurement that collects information that is proportional to epsilon, where epsilon is, say, 1 over n, that means that you have to repeat this experiment n times before you overcome the noise. You know that if you, even in classical physics, if you have a very noisy system, for example, you have a signal that's very noisy. What does it mean? That the information of the signal is very small compared to the noise. But if you are lucky and that thing repeats itself enough times and you collect that information, eventually the signal grows up as n, the number of times, the noise grows up as square root of n, so eventually you can retrieve the signal if you have enough repetition, okay? So if I have here a situation that the measurement is very noisy because the uncertainty of the measuring device is extremely large compared to the signal. That is what the condition for weakness. So the mass of the uncertainty is 1 and the signal is 1 over n. But if you collect enough information, you will be able to get the signal, what you are looking for, and the question is how does the disturbance go? The disturbance goes as epsilon squared. So therefore, if epsilon is very small, I will, from n times epsilon, I will get a signal, but n times epsilon squared, the disturbance will go to zero even for the whole ensemble. That is the secret of weak measurement, and now I will show it to you more in detail. This is just the story. Now I show mathematics. So I want to introduce the notion of weak measurement. I can ask the following question. Suppose somebody prepares n spin half particles, all of them in the same direction. This is the direction of the spin in each one of them. Is it possible for someone like me coming, not me, I'm not an experimental physicist, but some experimental physicists who come and find out in which direction the spins were pointing without disturbing even a single spin? First of all, why, if n is sufficiently large, why can you find it at all? If I take just a single particle, the spin in this direction, the spin direction, in this direction, the scalar product is cosine theta. So there is no way to make a measurement on a single one and find out whether it's this one or that one, because these two spins are not orthogonal. But if I have n of them, all of them pointing in this direction, or all of them pointing in this direction, the scalar product now of the one ensemble compared to the other is cosine theta to the power n. And this goes to zero if n is sufficiently large. That means that if somebody prepares for you n spins, all of them pointing in a given direction, you can find out this direction because all the spins pointing in different directions are orthogonal state. So there is always a way to find some measurement that distinguishes between two orthogonal vectors in Hilbert space. But the question is how to do it. It's possible, but how to actually do it. So the usual method that an experimentalist will tell you how to do it, he will say, okay, I will select a large subgroup of spins and measure on all of them the spin in each direction. I will find some of them with plus one, some of them minus one. If the group is enough, I will find sigma x average for all of them. Then on another subgroup, I will measure sigma y on all of them. And if it's sufficiently large, I will find what sigma y's average is. In fact, if I already know sigma x average and sigma y average, I know everything up to a sign. So I can also measure for a third group sigma z. So this is a way to do it, but it's a destructive way. It's used the usual hammer collapsing, killing of the system. That's exactly what we want to avoid. Because we want to look at properties that are there, the knowledge that we produce. So the question is now, can we find a different kind of experiment that will find what is the direction of this spin without disturbing even one of them, leaving all of them undisturbed? This is the limit of what I call risk measurement that gives me information without disturbance. So it finds something that is there, not that it puts it there, okay? And let me show you that you can do that. I think I will do it next time because, Alice, if you want me to go further?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Huh? Yes. Okay. All right. Let me show you how it works. First of all, I want to show you a beautiful theorem that I discovered, that it doesn't exist in any, as far as I know, in any quantum book, and it should be in every quantum book. Why? Look how beautiful this theorem is. If I have any operator, Hermitian operator A, and any vector in any Hilbert space, I can write this as equal, of course, to some other vector psi prime. But any vector psi prime can be written as A1 times psi plus A2 times some orthogonal state to psi. This is a geometrical statement that's very simple. If I have any vector in any Hilbert, in any vector space, I can find the components of this vector along the original vector, and what is left will be some orthogonal vector. I don't know which orthogonal vector, I only know that this product of that with that is zero, all right? Now, I also notice that I can always make A2 real, because I can always absorb any phase in the definition of psi orthogonal. So A2 is going to be real. You will see in a minute that A1 is real also. Now, a very, very surprising thing happens. These two, A1, A2, has very interesting mathematical feature that usually you connect it only with ensembles. I will show that A1 is equal to A average, where A average means the average of A in this state, which usually we think has to do with statistics, and A2 is equal to the uncertainty of A. These two things usually are associated with statistical properties of what you do when you have measurements on many, many particles. Here, this theorem tells you that it, these two coefficients appear mathematically as properties just of a single vector in Hilbert space and a single operator. Let me first prove it to you. The proof is very simple. I could give it as a home assignment, but I will prove it, because it's so important. So, if I multiply, I take A psi and multiply back by psi. When I multiply back by psi, I of course get here what is usually called the average of A. On the other hand, if I look here, I multiply by psi, psi times psi orthogonal is zero, so we get here psi times psi times A1. Psi is normalized, so this is equal to A1. So A1, the coefficient here, is simply equal to what is usually called the average of A for many, many systems. But here it appears in the mathematical properties that will be very significant later. Now, the second step, I take this vector and multiply by itself. Namely, I take the vector A psi and multiply by itself. So first of all, I know that because this is a Hermitian operator, I can bring it here. So this will be equal to psi A square times psi. But this is, of course, what we call A square, the average of A square. So this time, that gives me the average of A square. Now let's see what happens here. I take the vector and multiply it by itself. I get A1 square from here plus A2 square. And the cross terms are zero because this is orthogonal to that. So therefore, I know that this is equal to A1 square plus A2 square. A1 square is A1 average square, is A average square. So lo and behold, A2 square is equal to the average of A squared minus the square of the average, which is indeed what we call delta A squared. So, you have beautiful theorem. Beautiful theorem that so far is a mathematical theorem, but you will see in a minute why this theorem is important for storytelling. So this theory tells me that if I have any vector in Hilbert space and any Hermitian operator A, I can write this result as the average of A, so-called average, that has nothing to do with average now, because for a single system, times psi, plus the uncertainty of A in the state psi, times some orthogonal state of psi. And these two things, that usually are supposed to be the statistical properties of the ensemble, appear here as mathematical properties of a single quantum system. Okay? This is going to be very important. All right. That's the beginning of all the beautiful weak measurements. I will show you just one theorem, and then we'll continue next time. Suppose I have an ensemble of n particles, all of them described by the same state. A product from n equals to 1 to n times the vector psi n, the vector psi of the particle n. So I have n particles, each one of them described by the same vector psi, and this is psi for the whole ensemble. Okay? Now I want to prove the following general theorem. If I look at an operator A total, so it's A that acts on the ensemble, which is equal to the sum of individual operators, those act on each individual particle, divided by N. Okay, so it's an operator that acts on the whole ensemble, and it's equal to sum of individual operators divided by n. If this would be number, this would be the way to define the average of A. But here we discuss so far string operators. And now I want to prove a theorem that if I look at A total times psi for the ensemble, this is equal, I will prove to you, to the individual average of A for a single particle times psi total plus some remainder delta psi, where the scalar product of delta psi times itself goes to zero as 1 over n. It's equal to 0 plus minus 1 over n. So when n goes to infinite, this becomes an exact statement that each operator of this kind, for any observable, times the ensemble, leave the ensemble unchanged, and give you an information on the value of this operator for each particle. So at the limit, when I have enough particles, I can find all their individual properties, because if I know the average for each particle, the average for each individual observable, I know everything about this particle. So I can find the information, all the information on a single particle, provided I have enough replicas. It will be safety in numbers. I have enough replicas, then I can find the information of an individual one without any disturbance, as a real property of the system. I don't have now to say stories about the observer and the observed are all married together, they disturb each other. Here, provided I have sufficient replicas or sufficient repetition of the same one many times, it doesn't matter, I can now speak about real reality in the quantum domain. This ensemble has a real properties the ensemble has all the properties of individual systems really there, because I can observe it without disturbing it. So the proof of it will be next time, and all many interesting consequences will be next time, which will be on Wednesday. Of course, on Tuesday you will know everything, because the vector from Wednesday will come back in to the present and tell you everything, okay? But here, we'll discuss it on Wednesday. Yes?
May I propose the following characterization of quick measurement and tell me whether you agree with it? We always thought that when you make a quantum measurement, the result is lousy. It is inflicted with uncertainties and so on. Mm. People tried to fight it by making the measurement more and more accurate, and
more stronger,
lousier and lousier answers. Then you came and said, let's make the measurement itself lousy.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, from a lousy measurement, we got a less lousy answer.
Yeah, provided you have enough episodes. So, yeah. Now, the idea is that you have two options. One, you have a large disturbance and then you get large information. And the other, you have very weak disturbance and you have weak information. The beauty of this is when you make the information weaker and weaker, the disturbance goes much faster to be weaker, because it goes depth of square. Then you can get a weak limit in which you have no disturbance and still information. That's an important lesson, okay? See you on Wednesday. Thank you.